Now that's a parking spot.
Introducing the I may have underestimated the size of my car policy with accident forgiveness from American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote. Find an agent. Visit AmFam.com.
Optional policy features not included in base policies. Review policy for coverages and exclusions. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Catch us on iTunes or visit audiogyan.com for more Gyan sessions. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
I recently had a small revelation that why have I interviewed so many architects despite being a UI designer? I could also connect few dots about why am I so interested in architecture and education. Architect comes from a Latin word architectus, which comes from a Greek word architekton. Architekton is composed of two parts, archi, to be the first, and tekton, which means the builder. That is the first one who builds. And I was always fond of this builder as a word. It was very fascinating for me. On the other hand, edifice means a building, which doesn't mean just any building. To merit being called an edifice, a building must be important. So a mini temple can be edifice, or an educational building which can transform you can also be called as an edifice. Basically, Zen, spirituality, education, architecture, places of worship, I see in my mind all to be interconnected somewhere. And that's why I have none other than Prem Chandavarkar with us on Audio Gyan. Prem is a managing partner at CNT Architects, an award-winning and widely published architectural practice based in Bangalore. He needs no introduction to the people in the world of architecture and education. With experience of over 40 years, he's an academic advisor and guest faculty at several colleges of architecture. He has been documenting a lot of his thoughts and ideas online through blogs and videos. I met Prem at Frame Conclave last year and was in awe with his lecture on human within the architect. I'm going to post as many links as I can in the show notes below to read more of his stuff. And this is already being a very long intro. So without further ado, I welcome Prem. Thanks, Prem, for giving your time. And frankly, I'm really short of words to thank you for being on the show, giving your time.
Not at all. It's my pleasure. And thank you for inviting me here.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the basic premise is about, in fact, I would also like to thank Ruturaj Parikh from Matter for connecting me and also collaborating on this audio again. So the basic premise is Zen and education. So what I've, the way I would like to structure this episode is, Prem is obviously going to do most of the talking here, and I'll probably nudge him with few questions. The basic premise being like one of the Zen doctrines, which I'm very fascinated with, which is when you don't know Zen, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. When you're learning Zen, rivers are not rivers, mountains are not mountains. And when you have learned Zen, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. I mean, for simplicity, we can call it 1, 2, 3, or also we can call it thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. So I would parse almost all questions in this within this framework. And so Prem, first thing which I want to ask you is like, what's your definition of education? I mean, we can start with the thesis, and then what was the conflict or what was the antithesis which you encountered, and if you have reached synthesis in the last 30, 40 years of your understanding of education in general?
Well, one's understanding is still developing, but I would empathize perhaps most with the way it's defined by the famous Brazilian educationist Paulo Freire. Mm-hmm. And he says that education is not about acquiring knowledge or about acquiring skills. It's about being empowered to have the freedom to personally participate in the transformation of the world. So eventually that's the goal of education. You don't treat the student as an empty vessel into which you can pour knowledge and skills. You have to empower the student to recognize the student as a person with that own inner spirit, inner energy, and then facilitate the flowering of that spirit I think this is not a new word. It's captured in Indian tradition also. The word guru, the etymology of that word is the dispeller of darkness. And the guru is the person who lifts the veil of darkness that has been covered by the student, that is covering the student, a veil that might have come through social convention or some other force. And once that veil is lifted, a light that is shining within the student is revealed, both to the student himself or herself and to the world at large. And that should be the goal of education. So I see a strong correlation there with Zen when you're talking about it, because Zen is all about building inner awareness of the spirit.
Mm-hmm. But did you find any conflict? I mean, like, the reason why I put this this doctrine is because when you start off with a definition, you have certain, when you start off with an ideology, you have certain assumptions, and then you enter a conflict. So the classic example which I typically would like to pitch is that you say that nonviolence is not good, and that's the thesis. And then you enter a hypothesis, then why are these gods have weapons, and why do they talk about violence in certain stories and tales? And then finally you have like a synthesis that yes, violence is good, but maybe for like self-defense or pushing the crime. So there is this cycle of learning, unlearning, and then learning. So I wanted to ask you, like, is that definition of education changed in the due course?
I think the mainstream definition of education is not as per the way I just defined it right now. The mainstream definition is all about bringing the student into conformance with a predetermined notion of the world. And that is deeply damaging. And the reason that is damaging is that you define standards in terms of external benchmarks. You say there's a doctrine to be followed, or you say there's a proper way the world should be. And if you're always going for these external benchmarks, you're erasing the self of the student. The whole goal of education should be to light a spark within that self. So, for example, you mentioned this doctrine of nonviolence. If you just accept it as a doctrine, it's a rule you must follow, then you're not really getting into the spirit of nonviolence, because you're actually being very violent towards yourself. You're erasing yourself. What you have to do is realize that you have a spirit, and you see that same spirit in everyone around you. And once you see that same spirit in everyone else around you, and this is not something that requires some deep philosophy, this just requires everyday experience. In our relationships, we find how, you know, with the people we love, the same things make us laugh, the same things make us cry, the same things give us joy. And that's because we find those resonances in others. And once you see that same spirit, then you realize that to harm someone else is almost like harming yourself. Then if you are living nonviolence, if you're being nonviolence, that's one thing. But if you're just following nonviolence as some external rule, some doctrine that's been handed down to you, then you're really not practicing nonviolence. So education should be all about evoking that spirit. I think one of the phrases that made me aware of this very early in my life. I had the fortune, my first job out after graduating from architecture school was to join Kanwinder Rai and Chaudhary. And I was working under Murad Chaudhary. And Murad had been a teacher too. And he was one day just chatting with me and talking about his experience as a teacher. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, "I cannot teach architecture because architecture is not teachable in that sense. But what I can do is I can go to the school of architecture and I can communicate my passion for architecture. And if a student gets infected by that passion, then that student will learn architecture on their own." And I think that's really the goal of all teaching.
So does that mean, I mean, then where do these skill sets, these technical aspects of architecture will fit in? Just to extend this example further, then where will the practical aspects or the theoretical aspects will come in? Because what you're talking about is the spirit is the main soul of someone learning. But there are these external factors as well, right?
Yeah, but the problem is just because they're much easier to define, we tend to make them central. I mean, let me give you an example. I straddle both worlds of academia and practice, but I spend more time in practice than in academia. Hmm. And I've had very little formal involvement with academia. I'm not, you know, listed as a full-time faculty anywhere. I've never been, except very briefly for 2 years. But one of the things that I keep hearing educators say is about how they need to inculcate these skills and knowledge sets in their students so that the students are employable in practice as soon as they graduate. And this kind of attitude, which is very mainstream, but it bothers me a great deal. And it bothers me not as an academic, but as a practitioner. Because I have found that it's actually very easy for me to cover gaps in technical knowledge. All I need to do is apprentice a young architect with a senior architect. And if they're intelligent and willing to learn and hardworking, within 6 months, they're up to speed. They're reasonably productive. But I cannot cover for gaps in the ability to think, to be creative. I'm not organized to do that as a practice. I have to depend on the schools to do that and feed me with graduates who have that ability. So what happens when I don't get graduates who can do this? I mean, one is lucky and find some who can do it, but quite often it's because of their own inner ability rather than what the school has taught them. But if I don't get graduates who can be critical and are thinking, and that starts shaping my practice, and then I become a commodity practice because I cannot differentiate myself from any other practice because we're just, you know, the nuts and bolts skills. And once I become a commodity practice, the only way I can differentiate myself from competing practices is by fees, by lowering my fees. And this culture of undercutting each other on fees is an ingrained aspect of architectural practice in India because of the failure of the educational system. So this claim to serve practice is actually undermining it. So yes, the skills are necessary, but you got to remember that skills acquire a value only when they serve some deeper purpose, some purpose of fulfillment, some purpose of transcendence, some purpose of beauty or of joy. If skills help us to, you know, are bridges that connect us with that, and we cannot look at skills as things in themselves.
Beautiful. So I had done one audio again long time with one of my friends. He's been teaching for 10 years now. And what he mentioned was that, like, we had a debate of like, okay, like there is a classical debate of theory versus practical, right? And then if you say, okay, let's have a completely practical school. So you give two stones and you build all over again. Is that a recommended path? Or then you just stand on the shoulders of giants and then build on top of it? So I can see some sort of like pedagogical system ka argument in your thing. So if you can extend that and help us like share your view on how much theory or how much practical would make sense. Because you're bringing in a third different direction also of intent. Right. So yeah. Like if you can, how like what would be the ideal system then?
Well, I mean, firstly, I just emphasize that we can't avoid the question of I'd rather use the word purpose rather than intent. Okay. But, you know, we are always trying to deal with what is our purpose? Why am I here? What, you know, why have I specifically as a being been placed in this universe? We're always trying to find some meaning in that. So I think, and that's what motivates us and drives us. Okay. But to get back to your issue of practice and theory, one has to look at the relationship between the two. And there is a fallacy we tend to operate by, which says that you first construct a philosophy or a theory and then you apply it in practice. So practice is just applied theory. But actually, that's not the case at all. They cover the same territory, but in different directions. Practice starts from the general and moves to the specific. So let's say I'm doing a project. I start with something general, like a design brief. Then I start getting into specificities of the site, and then I might come up with maybe three conceptual options. Then I pick one to develop. Then I convert that into a schematic. Then I have to see how I can make that constructible. Then I have to manage the contracting process and the construction process. Now, you see, at each step in the process, I'm moving more and more to the level of detail. And if I do nothing but that in my life, then as my center of gravity as a person starts getting shifted to the level of detail. And I become that nuts and bolts architect who cannot connect to wider issues. Theory does exactly the opposite. It looks at a very specific observation and seeks to generalize it. Say, what rules, what principles can we derive from this observation or this very specific set of observations? And it tries to develop wider and wider viewpoints. And if I do nothing but that, my center of gravity as a person moves to the level of abstraction and I become the stereotypical ivory tower academic. So the two work best when they contradict each other, when they critique each other, when theory is a way of critiquing practice, practice is a way of critiquing theory. And we made a great mistake in segregating them into separate spaces. We say theory belongs in the world of academia, practice in the world of design firms. But we need spaces both in the educational institutes and in the practicing firms. Both have got to be spaces that combine theory and practice. Mm-hmm. Those who are effective professionals learn how to do this. But that's not the way the education system schools us.
Correct. So I have to keep listening to this again to understand. But broadly, what you're trying to say is one. Probably practice moves from macro to micro, and that's where you become specialized. And then the other one is at a micro level, you understand things to understand the macro part.
Okay. Let me give you a concrete experience example to explain this.
Yeah, please.
One teaching experience I will always remember when a good friend and professional colleague who's also very interested in education, Navnath Kanade, and I, actually a whole group of us had gone to the College of Architecture in Hassan. And but Navnath and I were paired together, and we were talking to students in first year of architecture school. And we were talking to this young girl who was doing her first ever architectural design project. They'd just done some courses in basic design before that, but this was her first architectural project. And she was just beginning on it, and she was terrified. She said, "I can't do this. It's asking too much of me." So we asked her why not. And the project they'd been asked to design was a small kindergarten. And she said, there has to be a path from the front door of this building to the entrance gate of the compound. I don't even know how wide that path should be. How can you expect me to design an entire building? And somehow Navnath and I didn't answer that question directly. So we started asking her, okay, if you're walking along that path, how much space do you think you'll take? Oh, this is a kindergarten. You're probably holding a child by the hand. How much space will that take? Oh, there'll be someone coming from the opposite direction. Oh, that person also might be, leading a child by the hand. And through these sort of, step-by-step questions, she arrived at the conclusion that the path needed to be between 2.5 and 3 meters wide. And when she arrived at this conclusion, Navnath said to her, "See, you knew the answer. Why did you ask us?" And I'll never forget the light that lit up in her eyes. And I strongly believe it's not because she learned the width of a path, but she had learned that she could interrogate her own experience to find the answer to a question that she wasn't sure what the answer was. So this, it's a very simple example, but this question of interrogating your experience, theorizing your experience. And then once you've theorized it, you actually test it with your body. You test it with a practice, what you've theorized. So it's that back and forth critique. So I think this is a small, but it's a powerful example because it illustrates a very deep principle. Mm-hmm. And that's what education should be doing. We have a very misplaced sense of education. Actually, the word curriculum, for example, if you go to any college, and I've been on some academic boards in colleges in India, and you ask them about curriculum, and they'll just talk about syllabus, about content. And they'll say, this is my curriculum. This is my structure of courses. And within each course, this is what will be taught. This is the skill that will be taught. This will be the knowledge that will be conveyed. But curriculum actually has three components. And content is just one of them. The second is values, and the third is pedagogy, the notion of teaching, how you teach. And it's at pedagogy you have this spark of connection, where you awaken the student, you lead the student through the process of interrogating their experience. So I think that is actually the core of education, but we privilege content, and that's a deep mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is like a really thing to think about. But then so looking at the practical aspect, do you think that's why we have these two notions, that he's not civil but he's educated, or he's educated but he's not civil? Do you think that this is because of the system? In fact, if you can explain or just share your thoughts about what is being civil or what is being educated also. Because we have like really talented and educated people on Twitter but trolling someone. I mean, I don't understand where is this coming from.
I think the first thing, if you are truly educated, is that you will be humble. Mm-hmm. Because you will have discovered the glory of the world and what architecture can be. There's a wonderful story about Louis Kahn, who was talking to his students, and he said architecture is, and he paused, and the students thought he was searching for the next word. Then they realized to him it was a complete sentence: architecture is. And he goes on to explain that the spirit of architecture is eternal, and every work of architecture is a quest to reach that spirit. And that is what we are trying to do. We are trying to connect with a purpose, with a world that is greater than ourselves. What are we trying to do? What am I trying to do when I do what I would call a good design? I think I would do a disservice to architecture if I just looked at it from an egotistic sense of saying, I want to win recognition for this. I want to win all the design awards. Yes, it would be nice to win the awards, but the primary purpose should be to offer something emancipatory, something transcendental to the person who's inhabiting that space. Mm-hmm. And for that, you have to connect to something that is greater than yourself. And if you do that, then you cannot help but be humble, because you're always connected to something that is far greater than yourself. And I know that when I make this argument, a lot of people say that can't be true, because there are a lot of great architects who are known for their egos. But my belief about that is, when you're in that creative moment, you are lost. Your ego is dissolved. You are just in awe before the spirit of architecture. The problem is, you come out of that moment. You're not forever just designing. And when you come out of that moment, if you come out of that moment with your ego dissolved, you're coming out naked and vulnerable. So how do you deal with that? And there's some who learn how to deal with that. So, you have architects like master architects like Jeffrey Bava and Carlos Capa, who didn't want to talk at all. They just presented their work and they didn't want to say anything more. But there are other people sort of compensate by going to the other extreme, by suddenly covering their nakedness with ego and a very strong ego.
Very, very fascinating. Very beautiful. And then, like referring to my introduction, I spoke about edifice. So, like, do you see any relation between the etymology of these words, education, coinciding with architecture, coinciding with Zen in general?
I can't say I'm a real scholar of Zen, so I'm not sure how to answer that question.
No, but at least edifice is what I've recently trying to dig around about the etymology also. And it somewhere says that it means to build. And metaphorically, or that is metaphor, but here you're actually building something. Even education builds a character of a person. So do you see any synergy between these two, three concepts?
I equate the word edifice with monument, really. And it's talking about a certain kind of architecture that's monumental. Mm-hmm. And for example, I was just having a discussion in my office yesterday. We are going over a passage from Victor Hugo's Hunchback of Notre Dame. And his argument in that chapter is that until the printed book came about, architecture was a register of human thought. If a generation wanted to immortalize an idea, architecture was the best way to do it. And therefore, it acquired this name of being the mother of the arts. But once printing came about, an idea could be copied thousands of times and scattered all over the world, and architecture could not compete with that ubiquity. And so therefore, the printed word became the primary register of human thought, and architecture just became, you know, was reduced to geometry. Now, that's an argument that holds water when you just talk about monumental architecture, and that's what Hugo is talking about. And and the translation of his book in most versions uses the word edifice, in fact. So there's the monumental buildings, there's the cathedral, there's the, you know, the palace, and which is communicative, you know, and at one time the carvings of stone were literally narratives to communicate. But there was a mass of building behind it which didn't have that role. So so once you talk about this notion of the edifice, you're talking about something that stands out from the rest of building. It's, you're not equating architecture with building. And I mean, Nicholas Pevsner, the famous architecture critic and historian, made the famous statement saying a bicycle shed is a building, Lincoln Cathedral is architecture. So so I think that's a false distinction, because the role of architecture is not to communicate. The role of architecture is not to be just a medium for the expression of an individual genius. The role of architecture is to create spaces for inhabitation and to empower and emancipate the kind of inhabitation you can create. So I believe that meaning in architecture is something that accrues over time through the process of inhabitation, because people, you know, build memories of that inhabitation. And So the test of great architecture is not, do you look at it and say, wow, the test is, can I live there for 5 years and look back at those years with affection? So if you start looking at it that way, everything is architecture, because you're looking at architecture from the viewpoint of experience, not from the viewpoint of communication. So I think this, you know, looking at it from the viewpoint of experience rather than communication changes the picture. And so I don't use the word edifice at all.
Okay. I guess I'm trying to connect in my mind at least the dots, because I mean the experience of things which you are experiencing right now in this internet world is almost very homogeneous, and you are not able to like Atul Pete, one of the greatest playwrights of Marathi literature, he calls it Sapatikaran, which is like flattening everything. And this is also seen in architecture as well. So I think it's borrowing from the experience and then manifesting itself into these structures as well.
Yeah, but that's if you're looking at it from the viewpoint of visual impact.
Correct.
But there's so many other dimensions you can look at it. For example, one of the questions I often get asked by students is, how can I create an architecture by students in India? How can I create an architecture that is uniquely Indian? Do I just have to adopt the historical styles of the past? Mm-hmm. Can I do something that's contemporary yet Indian? And my answer to that is yes, but you've got to look at other clues. For example, the angle of the sun. Now, many of us might be influenced by buildings we see designed in Northern Europe or the United States or the United Kingdom. Or parts of Japan, and these are all latitudes that are far north of us, and the angle of the sun is much shallower. It's closer to the horizontal. So in that kind of a sun, the shadow cast by the vertical plane is stronger. In India, which is more tropical and temperate, the sun is much more vertical, so the shadow cast by the horizontal plane is stronger, and therefore and also because we are a temperate climate, you have the luxury of creating a transparency across space. So actually, to see that variation in light across the ground plane, so if you're looking through a courtyard house, for example, and you see the ground plane is dark and then light and dark again and light beyond that, That's a fundamental part of the Indian aesthetic in architecture. And if you do that, you can do something that is highly contemporary yet totally Indian, because it will come to life only in the Indian sun. And then you start becoming aware of how the sun moves, and you start becoming aware of the slope of the land. And there's so many things in architecture, if you're getting into the true spirit of it, that are so unique to that site, it's not reproducible in the cut and paste of the internet kind of strategy. Yes, there are architects who do operate that way, but that's something very shallow.
Yeah. And speaking about environment or sun in general, is there any other axis also? I mean, like, climate is one like big part, environment. One is obviously the culture and the upbringing and what sort of education you got in understanding architecture at large. And is there any other access to it?
I always keep telling youngsters that what you have to learn to do is trust yourself. The greatest access is, you know, access to what you're seeking is within you. Let me give you another quotation from Louis Kahn to illustrate this. He said that a great building must start with the unmeasurable, must go through measurable means while it is being designed, and must end with the unmeasurable. Mm-hmm. And when he talks about the unmeasurable, in one of his other discussions, he talks about saying, can I capture the consciousness of a rose? So he does things like in the Salk Institute, he says he seeks to capture the consciousness of the sun. Mm. So there's this courtyard with whose access is directly west towards the setting sun. And he has this narrow water channel down the middle of the courtyard, which becomes so dynamic in the way it reflects the setting sun. See that space at that hour of the day is magical. I have not seen it myself, but I've seen videos of it. And even the video is captivating. So here he said, I want to capture the consciousness of the sun. And he's done it. And he's had to go through measurable means in the process, that in working out the proportion and materiality of the courtyard. But at the end of it, it becomes unmeasurable again. Now, how do you know the unmeasurable? And a lot of the things that are valuable in life, what you consider valuable in life, you ask any ordinary person, you don't need to ask an architect this, and they'll say, what I value is love, affection, friendship, wonder, beauty, joy, things like that. Now, these are all intangible things. They're all unmeasurable things. But when you live them, you know their reality within your body. Mm-hmm. They are real. They're not something abstract. They're real. They affect you to the point that it can even have physiological impacts, right? I mean, if you're stressed, you suffer ill health. If you're calm and peaceful, your health is better. So it actually has tangible impacts, but it's the intangible that has the most powerful impacts. But your own body is the first site of discovery. And then the second site is to see the resonance between your body and another person's body. And this is the way we intuitively live, okay? But so, like, how do you find friends? You don't find friends by constructing a philosophy of friendship. If you try that, you wouldn't have friends. You have friends by just spending time non-judgmentally, listening and finding those resonances. And then friendship emerges, and you give it the space to emerge. And all, I mean, that's the way we intuitively live, but we're schooled to forget it. As children, we are intuitively within wonder, always seeking to learn. We're absorbing, the stuff like sponges and always thirsty for more. But we're schooled out of that. We're schooled into a sophistication. We're told to believe in sophistication rather than to remain in wonder.
Yeah.
So education is highly misplaced in its priorities. And I think a true teacher will always connect with that.
Mm. Yeah, so true.
And when the teacher does that, students stay connected. I once heard a lecture by this a famous tennis coach, Nick Bollettieri. And although he has never played professional tennis himself, he's coached, amongst his students, I think there are There's some 10 people who reach the number one ranking in the world. And he said, how do I measure my success? He says, I measure my success by the contacts my students have with me after I've stopped teaching them.
Wow.
And, you know, if they keep coming back to him, they might have stopped playing tennis. They might come, they might call him to talk about something completely different, not tennis or something like that. But he says, if I've done that, then I've lit the spark, and that connection of the lighting of the spark is there, and it will always remain. And you think back to who are the sort of, you know, formative teachers who have really valued you. You feel driven to stay in touch with them. You don't feel the relationship is ended when I graduate. Because so that's what I say, pedagogy, the spark of pedagogy is so important. The human connection is actually the core of education, and that's what we need to get at.
Very true, very true. In fact, this Louis Kahn quote which you mentioned about, I had just introduced with that when I did an audio again with Vijay Ramachandran. So we spoke about the same lines. Very, very interesting. In fact, and one more thing which I remembered is that I recently read somewhere that, like, there's a great author, writer, everything, like a multi-talented artist named Pula Deshpande.
Yeah.
And someone asked him that, how can I be unique in the work I do? And he just say, do good work. And it will be sort of unique. So I can, like, I'm just connecting the dots and trying to build something in my mind. Anyway, so I'll conclude with one last question. So, like, what is the long term?
Can I just say, since you mentioned this thing about unique?
Yes, please.
There's a beautiful passage by the dancer Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, there is something that flows through you. And because you are unique, what will come through that flow is also unique. And if you suppress that voice, the world will lose something. So you have to keep that channel open. And I interpret what she's saying as stuff that is transcendental, eternal. Mm. When you're a creative person, you make it reborn every day. And that's the beauty of life, that stuff deteriorates and you give it another birth. That's what life is all about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the universal being reborn through the unique is what it's all about. And so if I'm creating something, I have to give it my voice, but in a way that touches with something that is universal and eternal. And that's what I should seek to do. And when I do that, I connect with what the scholar of myth, Joseph Campbell, talks about when he says that he argues that we do not seek the meaning of life. That's what people mistakenly believe. But he says what we truly seek is the rapture of being alive.
Wow. Amazing, amazing. So Prem, I would like to conclude with one last question. So, which is, like, what's the long-term future of education? Given not just the because when I was speaking with Bijoy, and he said that we are dealing with materials here, we are dealing with earth, and we are dealing with this sort of things, and, like, how can online classes are going to possibly help, or YouTube videos are going to help. So I don't want to restrict in such a narrow spectrum, but at like a very broad spectrum of education in general, of how are, what's the story with values, what's the story with the skill set, and you must have given some thought about it. So if you can share that, we can conclude with that.
I think education will work only if it touches the core of what it is to be human. And there are some things that are limited if you try and do that online. So I agree that with what you said, Bijoy said. But on the other hand, online can have a sort of profound role also. So, like what the Khan Academy develops, the idea of the flipped classroom. So you don't come to class to hear the lecture and then go back home to do your homework. What you do is you hear the lecture at home online through a video, which you can pause and rewind and work at your own pace and discuss with a friend while you're watching it. And then you come to class to work with peer groups on projects. So you start learning from your peers also, and not just from the guidance of a teacher. So those kind of mixed formats, I think, are very powerful, and that's the future of education. But we have to realize, yes, there have been profound changes in, you know, the digital world is, you know, that we know today, it didn't even exist 10 years ago. And there is profound change. But you got to remember there are, you know, centuries and centuries of evolution that have conditioned us, and we can't change the core of what it is to be human so easily. And you have to become aware of that. And that basically, you started with talking about Zen and education, and the spirit of Zen is all about becoming aware. And it's not that you change what you're doing, it's just that you do it with a different awareness. There's another Zen saying that before enlightenment, chopping wood, carrying water. After enlightenment, chopping wood, carrying water. But you have understood the beauty. Yeah, I'm adding something to that saying. But you know, you have understood the beauty and the spirit of water in the process.
Yes, absolutely.
And so you have to connect with that core, and that's fundamental, and that's not going to change. Whatever technological changes we throw at it, that's not going to change so fast. So you accept it as. And you work with it, and if that happens, we will learn what it is, you know, to teach, what it is to educate. But if we don't do that we'll be just holding this false mask of propriety, of skills, of all kinds of other things that don't touch that core at all.
Brilliant. I think this is a good note to end. I'm so very thankful to you and Matter and Ruturaj for helping me in this, like sharing your knowledge. It was really, really enriching. And once again, many, many thanks.
My pleasure. My honor.
Okay, thank you. That's it.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher, or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.
At Speedway, we've always been here to get you what you need when you need it. We're committed to keeping our stores open, clean, and safe, so you can stay fueled and refreshed all summer long. We've got cold drinks for hot days and frozen drinks for even hotter ones, plus energy boosts, quick bites, and pick-me-ups. We're always on your way, and we're always here for you. So no matter what you need, when you stop by, we'll be ready. Now, any Speedy Freeze up to Mighty Size is just 99 cents.